I'm glad you're here for another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word. We're going to start in Numbers chapter 12 in just a moment. But before we go there, I need to bring to your attention some extra biblical Jewish history, could say tradition, that helps us understand who is being referred to in Numbers chapter 12, verse 1, as Moses' Cushite wife. Because as I tried to explain when we were closing up last session, Zipporah, the wife of Moses from Midian, is not Cushite. She is from a Semite group that is related to the family of Abraham. Whereas the Cushites were dark-skinned people descended from the grandson Cush of Moses, or not Moses, of Noah. And so two different women in Moses' life. And the place that we find out about this Ethiopian or this Cushite woman is in the Jewish book called The Antiquities of the Jews by Josephus. It's book number 2, chapter number 10, and it starts this way. Moses, therefore, when he was born and brought up in the foregoing manner, came to the age of maturity, made his virtue manifest to the Egyptians, and showed that he was born for the bringing them down and raising the Israelites, and the occasion that he laid hold of was this. And so when Josephus tells the story as a traditional Jew, he says, this is when the Egyptians first found out how strong a guy, how amazing a leader that Moses was, and that when he took up the Israelite cause, they knew they were in trouble. So that's pretty much the introduction. So then it says, the Ethiopians who were next neighbors to the Egyptians, that's to the south, made an inroad in their country and seized upon it and carried off the effects of the Egyptians, who in their rage fought against them and revenged the affronts they'd received from them. But being overcome in battle, some of them were slain and the rest ran away in a shameful manner and by that means saved themselves. Whereupon the Egyptians, or the Cushites, followed after them in the pursuit, and thinking that it would be a mark of cowardice if they did not subdue all Egypt, they went on to subdue the rest with greater vehemence. And when they tasted the sweets of the country, they never left off the prosecution of war. And as the nearest parts had not courage enough to first fight with them, they proceeded as far as Memphis, that's up in the north, and the sea itself, that's the Nile area. The delta region of the Nile, while not one of the cities was able to oppose them. The Egyptians, under this sad oppression, betook themselves to their oracles and prophecies, and when God had given them this counsel to make use of Moses the Hebrew and take his assistance, the king commanded his daughter to produce him that he might be the general of their army. So the way the Jewish story goes is that when Egypt was being overrun by Cushites, by Ethiopians from the south, somehow in their supernatural attempts to get into the unseen world, they were told that the adopted son of the daughter of Pharaoh was the answer to their problem. Upon which, when she had made him swear that he would do him no harm, she delivered him to the king and supposed his assistance would be of great advantage to them. She withal reproached the priest who, when they had before admonished the Egyptians to kill him, was not ashamed now to own their want of his help. So apparently at an earlier case, they tried to kill him off. So the next part of the story is basically that Moses is put in charge of the Egyptian army to go against the Cushites. And the first part of the story, I'm not going to go over it. It's basically he has to invade Cush, And it has to go across a very deserty area with lots of snakes. Moses uses this deal of putting ibises, birds, into baskets and taking them along and letting them loose and letting these ibises eat up all of those snakes that are in their way. And that's the way that he was able to surprise the Cushites with his invasion and beats them. And of course, the Ethiopians or the Cushites began suing for peace. Okay? And so that's where I want to take the story up next. So we have a daughter of the king of the Ethiopians. Her name in the antiquities text is Tharbis. She happened to see Moses as he led the army near the walls of her city and fought with great courage, and admiring the subtlety of his undertaking, believing him to be the author of the Egyptian success when they had before despaired of recovering their liberty, and to be the occasion of the great danger the Ethiopians were in when they had before boasted of their great achievements, she fell deeply in love with him. Did you hear that? The princess of Cush, the princess of Ethiopia, saw Moses at the head of the Egyptian army, believed he was a powerful person and the reason why the Egyptians had turned the tables on the Cushites. And she falls in love with him. She gets Twitter-pated with him. And upon the prevalency of that passion, sent to him the most faithful of all her servants to discourse with him about their marriage. This is not uncommon. When wars are coming to their conclusion, sometimes the treaty that takes place at the ceasefire, at the conclusion of all the hostilities, includes a marriage between powerful families in the two opposing sides. And so the princess of Cush suggests to Moses, why don't you and I, since you are a prince of Egypt, get married as a means of bringing this war to an end? Josephus, who is a Jewish person living in the first century of the Christian era, says that Moses therefore accepted the offer on condition that she would procure the delivering up of the city, and gave her the assurance of an oath to take her to his wife, and that when he had once taken possession of the city, he would not break his oath to her. No sooner was the agreement made, but it took effect immediately. And when Moses had cut off the Ethiopians, or the Cushites, remember, he gave thanks to God, consummated his marriage, and led the Egyptians back to their land. Now, it would appear in our timeline that that event, that story, which is not inspired, yes, but it does seem to fit the information we're about to read in Numbers chapter 12. It seems that chronologically, that Ethiopian victory and Moses' marriage of a Cushite princess took place shortly before he killed that Egyptian taskmaster, hid his body in the sand, had it discovered, and ran off into the middle of nowhere to Midian and spent 40 years in exile. And so he left behind a Cushite wife, either in Egypt at that time, or maybe she was still in Cush. When Moses came back and took the Israelites out of Egypt, his Cushite wife would have found out that he was still alive. And apparently, she came to him at Mount Sinai. And Moses, I know this is a strange story for a lot of you, Moses apparently ended up with two wives at the same time. A Cushite wife that he'd married first, and a Midianite wife that he'd been married to the longest. Now, with that background, let's go back to Numbers chapter 12 and read the inspired text, the story of how this Cushite woman's presence in the camp caused some trouble. Chapter 12 of Numbers, verse 1. Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses, not with Moses, against Moses. So they are griping and complaining to other people about the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. So this black woman, because that's what she would have been, is present in the encampment. Maybe she's just recently arrived. And Miriam, in particular, who's Moses' older sister, she's probably about 6 or so years older than him, and his older brother, 3 years older than him, they grump about it. They said, verse 2, "Has he who is indeed spoken only through Moses, has he not spoken through us also?" So they're griping about Moses being the senior leader of Israel. And apparently part of their griping is that he was married to this Cushite woman, this black woman. And they didn't like that. "And he who is heard it." So God heard this grumping going on. And we already know he was not happy with the grumping going on at the fringes of the camp recently. And he brought judgment on that sort of grumping that's been going on. Verse 3, and this is one of those places where I want to tweak our translation a little bit. It says, "Now the man Moses was very meek, more than all people who were on the face of the earth." Now that is a legitimate translation of the Hebrew in some circumstances, but I don't think it matches the circumstances here. The word meek in biblical parlance in English is what we mean when we say that somebody is humble. They have abilities and all of that, but they're not showy about it. And that's fine. And I understand why the translators went that way. But the word in Hebrew actually means low. And it can sometimes be translated depressed, at the bottom. And I think given the larger context of where we're at in the Exodus, where Moses has just had a very close, near nervous breakdown because of everything that went on with the people getting under God's judgment just a couple of days away from Mount Sinai, and people being executed, and people crying that they wanted food, and God giving them a month's worth of quail, but ended up judging some of those with execution. That all has got to have worn on him in his leadership role. And now he has his own big sister, who is a prophetess, and his older brother, who is a prophet, griping at him because he's married to a Cushite woman. And so I think it should be read like this in verse 3. "Now the man Moses was very depressed, more than all the people who were on the face of the earth." He was at his absolute bottom. You ever been there? You ever had lots of trouble going on, and then people that you love and who are supposed to be loving on you suddenly start piling on for no good reason at all? Sometimes they just find something that they want to gripe about. And it just makes you depressed, doesn't it? Makes you just want to go to bed, pull the covers up over your head, and not do anything. Just wish it all go away. I think that is where Moses is at. And so God intervenes. Verse number 4. "Suddenly, He who is said to Moses and to Aaron and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tent of meeting. And the three of them came out. So they all get called to the principal's office. That's effectively what we're talking about here. Or to the command tent of the king. And he who is came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the entrance of the tent and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forward. So Moses is not there because he's in trouble. He's there because he's the one that's being hassled, and it's not right. And so God wants Moses to know this is being taken care of. So he said, that is God, hear my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, he who is, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. So that's the usual manner. God deals with prophets by giving them visions or giving them dreams. Verse 7, not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. That's actually quoted in the book of Hebrews about Moses. With him I speak mouth to mouth clearly and not in riddles, and he beholds the form of he who is. So God stands up for Moses and says, you two need to listen up. Prophets tend to only get dreams from me, or visions perhaps. That's not the way I deal with Moses. I talk to him face to face. I've shown him more of myself than I have to anyone else. So, why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? And the anger of he who is was kindled against him, against them, and he departed. So God just called Miriam the prophetess and Aaron the high priest on the carpet. But that's not the only thing he did. When God's presence dissipates from the tabernacle, verse 10, when the cloud removed from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous like snow. You remember what I told you? Leprosy is not Hansen's disease. Leprosy is a mark put on a person, place, or thing by God to indicate there's something not quite right here that needs to be evaluated. Miriam apparently is the major problem maker in this issue. She seems to have been the one that griped the most about Moses being married to this black lady. And so God strikes her with the mark that is ironically the removal of color from your skin. Not just simply at the surface level. It takes the color out of your skin down through multiple levels so that your skin becomes pale, translucent. And so Miriam, for griping about Moses being married to a black woman, gets turned really white. White as snow. Now Aaron, who's standing right there, sees this happen. He turned toward Miriam, and behold, she was leprous. And he's like shocked. Remember, these guys are like in their 80s. Moses is 81 in the second year of the Exodus. That means that Aaron has to be 84. Miriam has to be probably 86 or older, 87 maybe. And so this is not a bunch of kids here. These are leaders in the assembly of Israel. And one of them just got a major judgment from God. Now, Aaron said to Moses, oh, my Lord, do not punish us because we've done foolishly and have sinned. let her not be as one dead whose flesh is half eaten away when he comes out of his mother's womb. See, leprosy looks very wrong for your skin. Sometimes when a baby is born stillborn, very white, very sickly looking, right? A sick, pale color. That's what he's saying. Oh, Moses, you've got to do something about this. Don't make her look this way. Moses cried out to He Who Is, oh, God, please, healer, please. But He Who Is said to Moses, if her father had but spit in her face, should she not be shamed 7 days? So basically, if she had somebody either cough on her or insult her, possibly, she might have ended up having to do a time of being off limits, unclean, to deal with that. So God says, no, she needs to have a timeout. Let her be shut outside the camp 7 days, and after that, she may be brought in again. So Miriam was shut outside the camp 7 days, and the people did not set out on the march till Miriam was brought in again. So this is a very important story to remind us that even leaders need to be called on the carpet if they stray from God's way of doing things. They need to bear some sort of accountability for doing the wrong thing. Even if it's for a short period of time, there needs to be discipline. I also like to use this, and you can tell it in the way that I was presenting some of the wording, that we cannot tolerate prejudice in the Christian community, in the community of faith. We are all one blood. We are all descended from Adam and Eve. We are all descended from Noah and Mrs. Noah. We are all cousins or some level of relatives, regardless of what our ethnicity is. And so it is absolutely ridiculous to treat people of a different ethnicity as if they were non-human. And so we need to repent of that in our history, and we need to not tolerate it in our present time of service to the Lord. And anyone, whether they're a leader or a follower, who engages in that sort of prejudicial behavior needs to be dealt with severely. We've got to put a stop to it, folks. And so Miriam, I am sure, learned her lesson. It's another one of those things where I tell you from time to time, I'm looking forward to meeting some of these people in eternity and having a conversation with them. Or maybe just going to, I'm picturing some people are going to have like talks where they talk about the things that a whole bunch of other people want to know about. And they'll explain things to us as to how things played out eventually. I'd like to know how Miriam and the Cushite wife got along after this. My hope is that there was true repentance and that the two ladies got along splendidly from this time forward. But we'll have to wait and find out, see how that turned out. Well, we are going to move on in verse 16 to the next place where the tabernacle will be set up. So they can't leave until the timeout for Miriam is over. And so after that, verse 16 says, the people set out from Hazeroth, so that's where this happened, and then they camped in the wilderness of Paran. Now, where is that? What encampment is that? It's probably Rithmah that's listed in Numbers chapter 33. It's probably near what we would call Kadesh Barnea, which is about halfway between the top of the Gulf of Aqaba and the south end of the Dead Sea. The wilderness of Paran is located between those two points. And I believe about halfway between those two points is the authentic location of Kadesh Barnea. A lot of the Bible maps will push Kadesh Barnea to the west farther, but it makes much more sense for it to be closer to this this trade route that goes north and south out of the Gulf of Aqaba area. Now, what happens while they are in the wilderness of Paran? Well, they're there during the fourth month, probably, of the second year of the Exodus, and they are going to start getting ready to go into the Promised Land. The original plan appears to have been to come in from the south. And the first big place of importance to them that they would have come to was Hebron. And that makes good sense to me because that's the place where the patriarchs and the matriarchs are buried. Wouldn't it have been grand if that was one of the first things that they would have done was visit the graves of their ancestors? But it's not going to play out that way. And here's the beginning of the story as to the reason why. Chapter 13, He Who Is spoke to Moses, saying, "Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the people of Israel." So they are going to send out people to check out the property and to come up with plans as to how the Promised Land is going to be divided up amongst the 12 tribes and how they are going to start their occupation of this Promised Land. And this is where everything goes sideways and brings about the 40-year timeout. So mark your place. We'll come back right here the next time we get into the Word.